This is the 20th of May, 1987.
Senate Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources will come to order. Clerk will note the members present. The others are excused. I want to move through the agenda. Basically, I'm not sure exactly what order. We're going to want to get back to... We're going to go to a work session on 3097 at some point, but we have to get a little bit more information before we do that. So let me start by just opening the public hearing on House Bill 2041. And...
Lisa, Jack, can we have the sheet?
Lisa? Jack. Excuse me. We need the sign-up sheet. Okay, Don Hall. Is Don here? Yeah, come on up. And Dick, you want to come up too?
What, 2041?
2041. Mr. Hall, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Don Hall. I work as Director of the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries. House Bill 2041 was introduced by the department and is designed to improve the reclamation of aggregate mine sites. The bill was amended in House Committee, and we and our governing board support the amended version. I'd like to go back in time to 1983 interim, in the year following the 1985 regular session, when an advisory committee was formed to study the adequacy of bonding for aggregate mine sites. We've reported to the committee on the results of those advisory committees, and the bill, House Bill 2041, was drafted to reflect the majority recommendations of those advisory committees. The bill contains three principal changes to the current law. First, the bill would repeal a provision that allows the department to waive reclamation. We've never done that. I don't foresee a circumstance in which we would want to do that. The existence of that waiver provision for certain kinds of mine sites leads to confusion on occasion, and we recommend its repeal. Secondly, another principal change in the bill would be the removal of the current statutory ceiling for bonds for aggregate sites. We continue to feel that those bonds should be set at the estimated cost of reclamation. And the bill now provides for reduced amounts from that standard only for those aggregate mine operators who have demonstrated a good track record for at least 10 years of operation. The third major provision of the bill would prohibit the department from issuing future permits to an aggregate mine operator who has failed to reclaim a previous mine site. We already do that for metal mine permits, and we think the same provision should be extended for aggregate operations. Let me deal for a moment, if you'll bear with me, with Section 5 of the bill, which contains the major changes. I've mentioned that we feel aggregate sites should be bonded at the actual estimated cost to the department of reclaiming those sites if necessary. In our experience, the current statutory limit of $2,500 per site plus $500 per acre is insufficient for some such reclamation of orphaned mine sites. A second provision in Section 5 of the bill, one of the other key provisions, is a requirement that our field staff would consult with the mine operator in setting the bond amount. That's an approach we practice informally under existing administrative rules, and we're proposing that that provision on consultation be moved into the law. This same section of the bill, 5, would also provide an appeal process, which is similar to what we currently use under administrative rule. In cases of disagreement on the appropriate amount of bonds for such mine sites, the state geologist would be required to review the bonding amount and make the final determination of the appropriate amount, with further provisions for appeal of the state geologist's decision to the governing board in further through the Administrative Procedures Act to the Court of Appeals if necessary. Section 5 would also extend the current provision for blanket bonds to include all sites operated by members of a trade association. And finally, the bill, if enacted, would allow the department to reduce bonds for truly good operators by an amount of no more than 50%. In summary, we feel that House Bill 2041 will make the reclamation law more effective. From our perspective, it seems clear that the effective reclamation is in the best interest of the public and also the best interest of the mining industry. The Oregon Reclamation Law, in our judgment and experience, has been instrumental in creating a reclamation ethic in the state. The law is intended to ensure that mining is really only an interim use of the land, and we feel that through careful reclamation, mine lands can be returned to other and subsequent beneficial uses. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Questions for Mr. Hall? I have one. In terms of the reduced bond for operators that have 10 years experience and demonstrated sufficient financial ability to perform the reclamation, is that basically that they have other, is that that they need to show that they have other, I mean, the size of their company or whatever is sufficient so that they clearly have the assets to do the reclamation, even if they don't, even if they aren't bonded to the full cost of reclamation? I assume that would need to be defined more completely by the board, but can you give me any insight on what you think the board might do in terms of defining that provision?
Mr. Chairman, we would agree completely that that provision needs to be fine-tuned. We would propose to go into rulemaking before the governing board to provide details on that. I don't have a final sense of what those rules would say at this time, but clearly the provision in the amended version of the bill is not sufficient by itself.
Right, clearly. And this is probably a dumb question, but it doesn't specifically say in sub 6 that you will do this by rule, but do you have the general rulemaking authority to carry that out if you've given that statutory charge?
First witness.
Mr. Chairman, do you mean in Section 5?
Well, in Section 5, Section 5, subsection 6. Does not specifically give you rulemaking authority. I just want to make sure you had generalized rulemaking authority to take care of that stuff.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I feel we do.
Okay. Are there any other questions for the state geologist? Mr. Engstrom.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, first of all, for at least Senator Kearns and yourself, Senator Bradbury, this is the finally, we've ended a 10-year dispute with the department, and I think that the questions that we've all had have finally been raised. And for the life of me, I really don't know why we didn't come to this at an earlier date. But what it does, without going into any detail, we support the bill, and we think that it does some things that are important for the program. It promotes cooperation between the operators and the department, and that's very important when you're working on a day-to-day basis out there. The public is well protected. The bonds will be increased in those few instances where they may be needed, but bad operators are not going to go out and get another permit to operate someplace until they've made the state whole. The other thing is that it will reduce the cost to these operators that we've always been concerned about. And let me explain just for a brief minute. We have many operators who have been operating ever since the approval of the law. They've never had a default. There are no danger of a default. They've gone ahead and complied with everything. And yet they pay this bond cost every year. And the cost of the bond has gone up from about 1% up to 2% now that some people are paying. So it's money that's wasted all the time. So by granting those operators that look financially secure, that have a good background of operation and cooperation with the department, then those operators will then get a reduction in the bond and thus reduce that wasted money. So as you know, that this has been the long-term conflict that we've had. There's been the subject of, I think, many disputes, interim studies, and everything else, and I think we're probably not going to see us back again on this particular issue.
Any questions for Mr. Angstrom? A comment, I'm real glad to see the two of you sitting there together.
Yeah. Amen.
Is there anyone else who would like to testify on House Bill 2041? Hearing no one, will close the public hearing, open the work session.
So moved.
Senator Hamby moves House Bill 2041 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk, would you call the roll, please?
Senator Brenneman?
Aye.
Senator Hamby?
Aye.
Senator Karen?
Aye.
Senator Kintai?
Aye.
Senator Bradbury?
Aye. Motion is adopted. Senator Brenneman, would you do the honors on that one? Open the public hearing on House Bill 2173. Mr. Hall, you want to come up again, Don? And Martha Pagel. Welcome to both of you again. Proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Martha Pagel, Deputy Director of the Division of State Lands. I didn't get here in time to sign up, but Don has asked me to join him here. The bill, House Bill 2173, was introduced at the request, joint request of Division of State Lands and Department of Geology and Mineral Industries. The bill proposes repeal of some existing statutes that prescribe a program administered by the Division of State Lands. However, this program has not been actively administered for the past 15 or so years because of more recently enacted statutes under the responsibility of Department of Geology and Mineral Industries that establish a more comprehensive program. So basically what we're here asking this legislative assembly to do is to repeal these obsolete statutes on the Division of State Lands side and defer to the more comprehensive program that currently exists and is administered by Dalgami. The program relates to upland dredging operations and is basically established to require reclamation of mining sites where there has been, the mining is accomplished with a dredging machine. The Division of State Lands program affects only sites of more than 15 acres, includes bond requirements, and requires the person to develop a reclamation plan. This program is duplicated and more comprehensive under the Dalgami program. Perhaps I could just defer to Don now to talk a little bit more about the Dalgami program, and we could jointly respond to any questions you may have.
So basically, what this does is get the Division of State Lands out of the regulation of surface mining with a dredging machine, but that regulation firmly exists within Dalgami. So you're just out of it.
That's correct.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Karras.
On page 2 of Ms. Pagel's testimony, we find the, since enactment of the Mine Land Reclamation Act, the division has referred permitting decisions to the more comprehensive Dalgami program and has not issued separate licenses under the statutes proposed for repeal, so that in the 16 years since that enactment, you have not been engaged in this permitting process. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
So from 57 to 71, you did. And after 71, these statutes have simply laid dormant on the statutes?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Kearns, since 71, we've been advised that the Dalgami program, in effect, superseded our statutory program. And for that reason, we have referred any applicants who have approached us to Department of Geology and Mineral Industries. It's somewhat of oversight that they have laid dormant and not been addressed earlier to repeal them and get them off the books.
Well,
Mr. Hall.
Mr. Chairman, Don Hall, Department of Geology. We in our governing board endorse House Bill 2173 and certainly do recommend the repeal of what we consider to be a dead letter statute, that is the so-called Oregon Dredge Mining Act.
So you regulate it all now?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
An example of the bureaucratic
questions.
Machinery grinding very slow.
Are there any further questions for the witnesses? Is there anyone else who'd like to testify on House Bill 2173? Hearing no one, we'll close the public hearing, open the work session. Senator Brennan moves House Bill 2173 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk, would you call the roll, please?
Senator Hamby?
Aye.
Senator Karen?
Aye.
Senator Kintai?
Aye.
Senator Brennan?
Aye.
Senator Bradbury?
Aye. Motion is adopted. Senator Hamby, would you be kind enough? I want to open the hearing on House Bill 2673. Is Tom Hanlon here?
Mr. Chair,
yes.
Representative Hanlon apologizes that he won't be able to be here. He's asked me to testify in his place.
Okay, come on up. Identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members, my name is Carolyn Adamson, and I'm legislative assistant to Representative Tom Hanlon, who represents District 2. Can I ask Captain Lane to come up and join me from the state
police? Sure.
House Bill 2673 was introduced by Representative Hanlon as a result of complaints in his district about circumvention of the current law. The intent, it was felt, was not to assist by air in the hunting of wildlife, and people were finding ways to do that, for example, by hiring an aircraft pilot to take them over an area, spotting elk or deer, and being returned to the airport, then driving to the area while the pilot went back and circled over the area where the herd was. And there were other variations of that circumvention. In elk, it's particularly important because elk don't move very quickly. And they could stay in the same fairly tight general area for 6 hours or more. And it was a real problem. It's been a real problem with elk in Clatsop County in particular, but I believe that the state police have had problems in other counties in Oregon. This bill, it was felt, would close some of that ability to circumvent by adding in Section C the language, otherwise use an aircraft to assist another person in hunting or locating game, mammals, or birds, which would mean other than actually hunting from the aircraft or actually having the pilot assist you in the air. Also, it adds pilot log availability to the officer and provides names and times of the flight to that officer so that he could more easily enforce the law. In subsection 2, aircraft was substituted for helicopter because fixed-wing aircraft is a common usage for this type of hunting. The House Agriculture Committee changed the original 12 hours in the bill to 6 hours in order to accommodate late-night arrival of people in hunting camps and then allowing them to go very early hunting. If they arrived at midnight, they could go hunting at 6 in the morning. There was some worry on the House floor when the bill was voted upon that subsection C would limit management of activities by the state by ending simply or locating game mammals or game birds. They were worried that that would inhibit the state in locating them for management purposes. So Representative Hanlon has introduced the amendment.
The one amendment.
Right. And I have nothing else to say unless you have questions.
The dash one amendments are yours?
They're from Representative Hanlon.
Representative Hanlon, yes.
Okay. So, if I might, the problem is that people
use aircraft just to fly around and spot game, and then either they go get down on the ground and go after it, or they get radioed back where it is or whatever, and then they have other people go in and get it or whatever. That's the problem. It's not so much shooting from an aircraft. Okay. Captain Lane.
And Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bob Lane. I'm the Assistant Commander of the Fish and Game Enforcement Division of the Oregon State Police. We certainly are in favor of the passage of this bill. It strengthens the current statute and will provide us an ability to detect and apprehend pilots who take advantage of using aircraft for this sort of activity. This is not an uncommon practice, but in recent years, this thing has mushroomed to the point where we feel we need some additional teeth in the law to accommodate it. Our problem is not only with the elk herds, but it's also a problem with the antelope hunters in central and eastern Oregon and the deer hunters who are after trophy deer. They will land on BLM and Forest Service roads after spotting from the air trophy racks and will hunt immediately upon landing. Sometimes with the aircraft using Tundra tires, they can land in the high desert without any problems at all. There's one thing I would like to bring up. ORS 498-126 addresses the aircraft hunting law. However, it provides that the commission may designate areas where they can land, and Administrative Rule 635-65-730 states in substance that they can land at points other than established airports adequate for fixed-wing aircraft. We're not concerned with people landing in airports that are certified with the Oregon Board of Aeronautics and then hunting immediately upon landing. We are concerned about the other items I just mentioned. It may require that the commission take some action to adjust their administrative rules.
So, the commission, in line 12, basically the commission would probably designate as places that it's okay to land, what, commercial airports, or how would they, I mean, what? They just don't want them landing out on the field, right, or what, I mean, out on...
Right. The way it is now, it's an established airport, and our interpretation of an established airport is one that is certified through the Board of Aeronautics.
Okay. So it's a certified airport, state-certified airport.
Yes.
Would be a designated place currently.
Yes.
Okay. Any
Mr.
other
Chair.
Questions? Senator Hamby.
In context with that last question, what about if I had just an airstrip in my own backyard, not recognized by Aeronautics Association?
Some of those airstrips are certified and are registered with
Aeronautics. Some are,
the
but are all?
I don't know that. No. We do have someone here today from Aeronautics to answer questions if you need him.
I suppose there's a caveat for any kind of an emergency situation where you have to let down because you lost or what.
Sure.
Any further questions? Thank you both very much. Raleigh Rousseau.
Mr. Chairman, I really don't have anything to add. I think you've heard the position of the Oregon State Police and certainly the Department of Fish and Wildlife supports passage. It's a rather simple bill. It's one that's been around various times over the last few sessions, and I think that the issues have been addressed.
Any questions, Mr. Rousseau? Thank you very much.
Super bill.
Is there anyone else here who'd like to testify on House Bill 2673? Hearing no one, we will close the public hearing and open the work session.
Mr. Chairman, I would move the -1 amendment.
Senator Cairns moves the Legislative right. Council Amendment 2673-1, dated 5/7/87. Is there any objection to the adoption of that amendment? Hearing none, so ordered. Senator Hamby,
Moves House Bill 2673 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion? Clerk, would you call the roll, please?
Senator Kearns?
Aye.
Senator Kintai?
Aye.
Senator Monroe?
Aye.
Senator Brennan?
Aye.
Senator Hamby?
Yeah, aye.
Senator Bradbury?
Aye. Motion is adopted. Senator Monroe, would you be kind enough to carry that?
Sure, I'd love to carry this. I love all these.
I know you love all the animals, so I figured this is a good one for you. Open the public hearing on House Bill 2734. And why don't we just have Raleigh and Bob Lane and Raleigh Rousseau come back up?
Mr. Chairman, being that this is principally an enforcement issue, in part, I'd let Captain Lane lead.
Sure, that's fine.
I'll be, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'll be very brief in my testimony. We certainly support the passage of this bill for obvious reasons. It's a deterrent to the violators who enter upon the road closures. The State Police Department issued approximately 220 citations last year to persons that were primarily hunters, but others also that violated the road closure provision. Some of the citations were issued after the fact when we received information from complaints from the hunters that were in the area that took the license numbers of the vehicles. We're faced with a problem in that the officers that come across someone that has abandoned a vehicle or has parked a vehicle in a road closure area they have two options. They can either wait for the return of the hunter, or they can ignore the violation and go off and work some other area. If this was passed, it would be prosecuted as a violation and not as a Class A misdemeanor.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Kearns.
What is the violation? What is 496.992 to give you the power to do?
496.992 was revised by the last session of the legislature. In essence, it states that, except as provided by law, violations of any provision of the wildlife laws or any rule promulgated thereto is punishable as a violation in the manner prescribed by ORS 161635 when the offense is committed with no culpable mental state as defined. Anytime you allege a crime, you have to allege a culpable mental state. And when no culpable mental state is alleged, it's either no crime at all, or it falls into this category of the statute we're talking about.
And
violation.
What does that do to me? I'm without regard to Mike having a culpable state or not, mental state or not, I park my car in a place I'm not supposed to. My rig's parked where it's not supposed to be. I'm not there. And you cite me, what's that you cite in our chapter 162 or whatever. I'm trying to find out how much.
Okay, the bail, Senator Kearns, is $41.
$41?
Yes, sir.
Flat.
That's the bail schedule. It doesn't necessarily mean that is the fine.
That's the max. I mean, you write it at $41 and you go talk to the magistrate or the judge or whoever and try and jawbone it down from there.
Yes, sir.
All right.
Passage of this bill would simply allow officers to issue citations.
Ticket it and move on.
Right.
Now, it's my understanding that, I mean, this whole road closure issue has been an emotional issue, certainly in my district, and I'm sure in some other people's districts. There have been a number of road closures proposed, basically for the purpose of meeting the habitat goals of the Bureau of Land Management, for example, for elk habitat, by closing roads. And as they cut more and more timber, they may need to make some other adjustments in their management plan to ensure that there's habitat. So they have been involved in road closures, and this would be a way to help, and I guess, you know, basically this would be a way to help enforce those road closures.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, Raleigh Rousseau, Department of Fish and Wildlife, that's correct.
Chairman, there are actually two types of road closures that we're involved with, one of which is the most popular and most visible is those that are closed for during the hunting season in the fall that have only main roads open in the woods and then allows the hunters to be on foot rather than having vehicles travel all over and allows a more quality operation. Those are very, very strongly supported by the hunting fraternity. But they do take quite a bit of enforcement, and this is one of the enforcement problems, loopholes that you would be correcting with this bill. The other one is the kinds of agreements we enter into with basically the land management agencies, principally Forest Service and BLM, where we put permanent road closures into effect. We have road closure plans that is for the protection of wildlife and wildlife habitat. And that's the other kind. Those are 12 months. Those never change. Those are gated roads, and people generally have to violate the gate to enter those.
Senator Kintyre.
Yes. Does this apply only to areas closed for game purposes, or would it also apply to areas that the land managing company or agency would desire to be closed for some other purpose?
Senator Kintyre, as I understand it, it's only those road closures that the Department of Fish and Wildlife enters into under its authority with the land management agency.
And other tourism projects, and I would appreciate committee's consideration. And at this time, I also want to concur the concern that was expressed by previous witnesses that the 3-mile buffer zone is too large, and I would like to see a compromise of 1-mile buffer zone to allow development to happen easier. That's the end of my testimony.
So let me just, what your concern is Foster Reservoir, mm-hmm. which is basically just east of Sweet Home.
Right there.
It's right there next
yes.
to it.
Yes. I mean,
but it's right just
at the border.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So that's what you're worried about, making sure that that area could qualify for some fast tracking.
That's right.
Okay.
Just so that they're not included in that 30-mile road, air miles.
Okay, I think we understand.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
A lot of Sweet Home people would like to come and testify today, but I gave them a rather short notice yesterday afternoon.
Yes, I gave you rather short notice yesterday. Okay, no, I know you have quite a contingent there.
That I'm in full support of this.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Nibon, do you want to just say something real quickly?
If I may, Mr. Chairman. In drafting, Russ Nibon, Chief Planner, Marion County, one of the workers on the original bill with Representative Abrams, originally in Goal 8, it said 30 air miles for major destination resorts. And unless I'm wrong, Senator Yee's bill converted that to 30 road miles.
That's right.
When we succeeded in negotiating a reduction down to 25 air miles, I called Marv Groves, the Linn County Planning Director, and said, I understand that Foster Reservoir is your concern. And I said, can you check your maps and tell me whether or not 25 air miles isn't as good or better a change than 30 road miles? And he said, unless you hear from me otherwise, you can assume that 25 air miles pulls the boundary back far enough to achieve the objective. And I just wanted to make it clear to the committee that we had proceeded on the assumption that the senator's concerns had been addressed by the amendment down to 25 air miles.
Okay.
And the reason we stayed with air miles is it's much easier to map air miles than it is to trace every road that goes out into the woods.
It's a lot easier.
25 miles. And so we thought that problem had been addressed.
All right. We have maps. We will get to maps in a minute when we ask Mr. Courtwright and Mr. Howe to come up. So, but first, let's get to Representative Agron's.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm glad to hear that, Mr. Chairman.
Right, we will make sure. We'll check it, okay?
I would appreciate getting the map to show that
right.
Sweet Home is out of it.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Senator Kearns.
It depends on where you put the pin before you draw the circle.
Well, that's
what,
clearly
what
true.
What equals 25, whether 25 air miles is better than 30 road miles, depends on where you put the pin before you draw the
depends on what road you drive on, too.
It also depends on what, yeah, I guess that's true.
I'll take the pen that excludes Sweet Home.
Now, this is clear representation here. Representative Agnew.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the opportunity to make a few comments. And I'd like to speak, if I may, to some of the comments that were made by Mr. Petrie and Mr. Clark.
You bet.
And also Genoa Hefke. I would ask you to be aware of those who would use this bill to serve a different agenda than for which it was intended. It was not intended to revise Goal 8. It was not intended to overturn the activities of LCDC. It was not intended to deal with or in any way substantially change the currently established rules on large destination resorts, but rather fairly narrowly focused on the development of small, as you put it, Mr. Chairman, the fast tracking of small destination resorts in appropriate places on marginal lands. And, you know, that becomes one of the major issues in this bill. To the best of my knowledge, it does not impose any roadblocks to the siting of large destination resorts that do not already currently exist in the Goal 8 policy. So it really doesn't, I'm surprised that people feel that this is imposing some difficulties that currently don't exist. I'm disappointed that it doesn't meet the objectives fit the concerns of the Association of Realtors. And I'm shocked to hear that they want the bill to fail because it doesn't do what they want, which, of course, what they want is what it never was intended to do anyway. So I seem to have brought forth a very modest little vehicle for...
That's right, Mr. Representative Agnew, we've got clear experience of that happening in any number of committees.
Okay.
Way around.
I'm a little surprised to find this modest little thing is suddenly... I had not intended to raise all of these broader issues or to address the apparently very legitimate concerns of these folks. And I don't mean to belittle them in any way, other than to clearly point out that they're boxing in the wrong ring as they try to address their problems in this bill. And with that, I'll...
Question, Senator Brennan.
Bernie, I don't know if you responded to Senator Otto's request for the one-mile buffer along with others. Could you respond to that now?
I guess I might say that in terms of the perspective that we had when we were working this bill and negotiating it, that was not a particular issue from my perspective. Okay. We did, as was previously pointed out, have a little working group that Representative Cease appointed to work the issues. That included Russ Nibon, as he said. That included Dick Benner from Thousand Friends, myself, Representative Anderson, and in the final stages, we were joined by Jim Ross, and incidentally, Fred Vanetta suddenly appeared and trailed around with us, although we did not invite him to bring his other agenda.
Uninvited, yes.
But he was there, and it was certainly welcome, but I resisted the inclusion of other concerns. So what I would say is that was the arrangement that we arrived at. And I don't have any strong feeling about it personally, except that I would hate at this late date to impose some condition that would suddenly put a different perspective on this little feller, which is very close to having some life breathed into it.
Questions for Representative Agron?
Senator Kinsey. Mr. Chairman, the question that Mr. Petrie raised, what about the resorts between the 76 units and 149, or the gap that was on? What about that?
That gap would have to meet the criteria for the large destination resorts. This simply goes up to a maximum beyond which the other rules take precedence. It just goes so far.
Well, but Senator Kintyre.
The other provisions cover just from 150 up.
No, the other provision...
I understood.
Okay. The original... let's see if I can find it here. Okay. The original had seating for 100 persons, 150 separate rentable units.
Right.
And that, I guess, was a minimum number. I would assume, you know, this goes up to 75 and $1 million and you know, reduced acreage and so forth. In order to qualify under this bill, you know, those criteria are set out. We have made no provision for that in-between area.
Yeah, we can get some clarification.
I would assume that they would have to meet the other criteria.
We will check on that with the other witnesses that are coming up.
All right. So they don't get left out in fact.
Yeah.
It is an interesting
question. It's a good question. Interesting point.
Any further questions for Representative Magros? Senator Karen.
Mr. Chairman, did the House Committee or have you created, or maybe one of the other witnesses has, if they have, I'd appreciate seeing it, a matrix for the, what would then be, if we adopted this, the two classes, and showing what the criteria for approval, citing approval, are for each? Because I think that's where the, because I have a hard time getting my mind around the 76 to 149 in where they fall and which column of criteria they would have to meet.
I can get that clarified. I think it's a good question.
And also to generally look at the overall picture.
We really looked at the picture that we saw as it existed and then carved out a little niche within that picture and said, on secondary resource lands, which are yet to be defined, though now in a time certain in this bill, if it meets this criteria, you're on the fast track.
Yeah, it basically the way the goal is today, you have to have 150 rentable units to qualify as a destination resort. So then the House amendment, I mean, the purpose of the bill was to provide for the siting of small resorts, which are between 25 and 75 rooms. So there's still, I mean, there's still a group in there between 75 and 150.
They're just motels.
That are motels. I mean, that are not considered either small resorts, you know, or big destination resorts. Okay.
Why are you doing questions for Representative Magros?
I'm not going to ask any more.
Don't cause trouble.
Senator Kintyre.
Representative Riggins, I think you said just now $1 million, but I read in the bill here $2 million.
That's the other one.
That's in line 23?
Yeah. If you look at line 40 on page 2, you'll get to the criteria that established the new standard.
I'm sorry, I didn't have a minute.
Okay. Engrossed bill on page 2, line 40.
Yeah, lines 32 through the end of section 4 are for smaller resorts, and the earlier part of section 4 is for bigger resorts. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Eldon Hout and Bob Courtright. And Jim Ross. Oh, you mean Eldon gets to get off the hook now, huh? Okay. Oh, he is, brother.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Jim Ross, Director of the Department of Land Conservation and Development. At the table with me is Bob Courtright, our destination resort guru, and author of the amendment to Goal 8. We had trouble when we were trying to address the question of destination resorts in the amendment to Goal 8. Trouble in terms of dealing with the smaller destination resort and differentiating the smaller resort from something that could be a major roadside motel as opposed to something that is a destination to which people, when they start their trek, are intending to arrive at. This bill does a pretty good job of trying to deal with what we were not able, in the time we were working on the destination resort issue, to adequately deal with. I think that Representative Agron is to be commended for the amount of work and bringing this bill as far as he has, in that, as I said, it does do a pretty good job. We have a couple of other issues with the bill that we want to share with you today. We do support the bill. We have, I think, three or four issues of an editorial nature that will help the bill. We have a couple of substantive issues to share with you, and I'm going to ask Bob Cartwright to go through that material with you and also to respond to some of the questions we've already heard raised. Bob?
There are three points that we'd like to suggest as refinements to the bill. I think they focus on the issue of distinguishing small resorts from other kinds of development. That was really our intent in developing Goal 8, was to distinguish destination resorts and resorts from other kinds of uses. And our concern with this category of smaller resorts, I think, reflects that same issue. Small resorts cover a great variety of potential developments, and the types of resources you've seen mentioned here are resorts related to hot springs or hunting or fishing lodges or similar very specific rural recreational activities. We think that's critical to defining a small resort and to drawing the line between a resort and a roadside motel. The specific suggestions we'd make are related to assuring that a resort is in fact tied to a recreational activity. And we suggest that doing that in a couple of ways. In the amendments that we've suggested to you, subsection F would be rewritten to have the county governing body decide on a case-by-case basis whether or not a resort is in fact tied to a rural resource. That's similar to what we ask counties to do now in siting of non-farm developments. We think that's because the nature of resorts is going to be such that you're going to have to look at them on a case-by-case basis to really determine that. The second suggestion we have is the relationship of the resort to highway traffic. We think this is really the acid test that separates roadside motels from resorts. Resorts cater to people who are going to the location for the purpose of recreating there, not simply stopping by as they're traveling through an area. And we'd suggest that you limit how small resorts are sited in two ways. First, that they screen visitor accommodations, the motel rooms or whatever else they're providing, from the highway so that they're not readily visible to passers-by, to the extent that that's physically feasible. And second, we're suggesting that outdoor advertising signs not be allowed, save for locational signs that indicate where it is in relationship to people who are traveling through. So it's clearly not intended to serve primarily highway travelers. The third suggestion is on the second page of our comments at the bottom, and that has to do with use of individually owned units as part of the resort accommodations. The Goal 8 amendments allows individual units to be counted as overnight lodging if they're available to the general public for 48 weeks out of a year. And that, we found, was consistent with the pattern of practice in the major destination resorts in the state right now. We think smaller resorts are different. When you have 25 to 75 units and a very specific recreational activity, you aren't marketing to the same kind of crowd that you are at, say, Black Butte or Salishan or Sun River. The market isn't to people who are using these similar to residential type units. So the language we would suggest would not allow individually owned units at the smaller destination resorts. There are three technical changes that we'd like to suggest. First, the use of the term visitor-oriented accommodation in the bill is a bit confusing. Visitor-oriented accommodations, as it's defined, includes overnight lodging, the actual rooms for people to stay in, restaurants, meeting rooms, and other facilities. And we think the bill means to say overnight lodging in that
in that setting, so that it's 75 or 25 to 75 units of overnight lodging rather than visitor-oriented accommodations. Second, since Goal 8 was adopted, the Columbia River Gorge National Scenic Area has come into law, and we would suggest that you define the excluded area at the gorge using that definition, since the one in the goal is now no longer in effect. And finally, the reference to excluded Goal 5 natural resource sites in the bill is much more encompassing than the exclusion in the goal. The goal limits it only to a relative handful of sites in each comprehensive plan, whereas the goal extends that to virtually any area that's protected. The best example I can give you is elk and deer winter range encompass very large areas in comprehensive plans. Those areas would be excluded under the language of the bill, and we suggest some alternative language for that subsection 5 of section 6, which would, we think, limit it to just the handful of sites, relative handful of sites that were excluded in comprehensive plans. Be glad to answer any questions you have.
Where did these, I mean, did these amendments spring freely from your mind, or did they come from conversations with other people, or how can you describe these amendments?
Well, we raised these issues, I think,
in the House Committee.
As.
Oh, okay, excuse me. Go ahead.
In the discussions that we had with Representative Agrons, I don't think that we agreed on the language or were able to come to agreement at the time that the House Committee was taking action. And so we agreed not to push the issue at that point.
I think we need to point out, Mr. Chairman, we are here in support of the bill. We feel that these, the editorial issues, of course, are of little consequence. The three issues of substance would be our preference to see what would be in the bill.
What
we are here supporting the bill.
What are the three issues of substance?
Oh, I'm sorry. Bob, you want to quickly cover those?
There, once again, the review on a case-by-case basis and the direct link between the recreational resource and the resort. The limit on location so that it's not readily visible from a highway or that it's properly, that it doesn't use outdoor advertising signs. And then the exclusion of individually owned units from the smaller resort category.
Okay, so those are the boldface type, F, G, and 5.
That's correct.
And you think that this sub 5, in your amendments, is a more tightly defined protection of some of those resources than the one in the current House bill?
Yes, it is. I believe that the intent of the language there was simply codify Goal 8 provision. The problem is that legislation can't refer to the goal as an administrative rule in the specificity that the goal is written. So it was necessary to rewrite that. When it was done, it was written much more generally. It just refers to any site that is protected in a comprehensive plan pursuant to Goal 5, whereas Goal 8 was limited to sites that were protected in spite of conflicting uses, which is only about, I can't estimate the area, but it must be only 5% of the area that's covered by all of Goal 5.
Okay. What did this map show us, or did you get to that yet?
That's, I think, simply in response to Senator Yee's concern about the location of that 25 air miles versus 25 road miles. And the outer limit of the heavy dashed line is the 30 air miles as it's presently in Goal 8. And the solid line inside of that is what we calculate to be 25 miles from the urban growth boundaries of Portland, Salem, and Eugene. That's what's currently in 3097. And I think you can see that while the city of Sweet Home is excluded under both the 25 and 35 air mile line, Foster Reservoir would be eligible under the 25-mile line in House Bill 3097.
Is Foster Reservoir right where it says Foster?
Yeah, it's just outside of that.
Because Green Peter is further up.
Yes, it is.
Oh, I see.
So Foster Reservoir is just this little blip here?
It's virtually under Foster.
That's what it is, okay.
It's very small.
Yeah, okay. Okay. So did you get a chance to show this to Senator Yee?
Yes.
Okay. Good.
I'll have to tell Senator Yee that those are in my district, not hers.
Sweet Home's in her district, though, you know. Okay. Any questions about the proposed
amendment? Is in her district, but the reservoir is in mine.
Okay.
All right. Well, Mr. Chairman, can I ask on these?
Please, go right for it.
Are these, if we do in fact have a destination resort guru before the committee, maybe I can ask, what about 76 to 149? Units. Where are they? Just medium to large motels?
Well, the objective of Goal 8 was to try to define destination resort, and we set some minimums on that we thought were related to the economies of scale of that kind of development. In looking at the resorts that are currently in the state, all of them are very close to that as a minimum size. As the smaller resorts, I think we've been really trying to grapple with, well, what is that category? And we've chosen some arbitrary limits that try to capture, well, that type of resort that's focused on a specific recreational activity. And at some point, I think you lose the amenity value of that recreational activity when you get to a larger resort that's focused in the small category on a specific recreational activity.
Could I expand a bit my understanding, Mr. Chairman? That is, you have to be of a certain size to make it economical to have a golf course, and another size to have something like a swimming pool. And then I guess what we're talking about with these little ones are they're situated to take advantage of not so much the specific natural surrounding, whether that be on the verge of some white water takeoff or whatever. I mean, I guess, tell me a little bit about what kinds of things you include in the economics. Maybe that'll help us through some of this.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Cohen, I think you've hit it very, very well, and that is that there is a substantial investment that's required in the recreational facilities of the larger resorts. A golf course is usually the key, and you have several supporting facilities, including swimming pools, tennis courts, bicycle paths, and to be able to afford to make the investment in that level of facilities, you have to have at least 150 units, and most of our resorts in the state currently have many more than that to be able to justify that level of investment in those kinds of facilities. And the smaller category is talking about, I think, a type of resort that focuses on access to a recreational activity like whitewater rafting or hot springs that is very specific, as opposed to a large investment in a golf course or swimming pools or similar activities. It's more focused on specific activities.
Well, then,
Let me finish my thought. So what we're saying here is we'll fast track the little ones because of their impact or their sort of minimal impact, as long as you keep them small. But we don't want to fast track the 100 unit place, and yet it's not big enough to really talk about creating it as a major destination resort with 100 rooms. So is that where we're at, sort of?
Yes, Senator Cohen. I think we're trying to grapple with the issue of definition of a smaller resort, and we think it is clearly something less than 100 rooms, and I think 25 to 75 hits the range that we're looking at. It's not to say that there couldn't be a resort in that gap, And we think the exceptions process is better suited to deal with the peculiarities of that range.
It's too big to be treated in a fast track, so you would accept something as big as 100 ought to go through whatever traditional exceptions you set out for these. Is that where we are with these middle groups?
So you can, Mr. Chairman, then you can get as upscale as you want to until the economics of 75 pencil you back into the red, and that's one point at which you quit. Is that correct?
The way it's structured now, yes, Senator.
Okay, so tell me about 24 and under. What do you do with them? They're in the nether world. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
That's the
wedge. The nether world.
Nether world. We have some in limbo between 76 and 149. They go back to the exceptions process. Above 150 above, we know exactly where they're at. And we're creating something for 25 to 75.
That's correct.
And then below 25 and below, they are in the nether world. They make either the exceptions nor the resort.
They could go through the exceptions process as well. Anything is eligible for the exceptions process.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Senator Cohen.
If I wanted to do my ranch then and set up a little dude ranch and kind of get it fast tracked because I'm going to set up a new game ranch with the acreage I put into fallow.
Mm-hmm.
I could fast track if I came to you and said, look, I'm gonna convert my barn to a
bunkhouse
and bring people in. That's the kind of, we could do that, right?
Yes.
25 of them.
If I had 25, I couldn't do it if I were gonna keep 10 people around. They'd just be regular visitors at my house.
That's right.
Anyway, you might be eligible under the EFU statute anyway.
Really? I could do that?
I'd have to have an economy.
It's possible. I think we've had a couple of questions about that. It would be possible as a home occupation if there were no new structures associated with it. It's just using existing dwellings.
Now you know how to do that, don't you? First you raise the roof 2 stories, and then you close that in, and you take the south wall out 20, 45 feet. When that's closed in, you take the north.
Okay. Any further questions for the witnesses?
Mr. Chairman, I think that conversation underscores the difficulty of the issue and further points out, I think, the good work that the Representative Agrons has done in trying to pull this together. It does do what we had a great deal of difficulty in trying to come to grips with when we amended Goal 8. We think that the suggestions